Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today we are taking reader questions, and helping me with that today, we've got Adam Taggart and we've got Becca Martinson here with me today. Hello, Adam. Hello, Becca.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Adam.
Hi, guys.
All right. Well, Adam, I'm going to kick it over to you. I understand you've got some very interesting reader questions. I've looked through them. They are fascinating. So let's get started.
They are. They are fascinating, and there are a lot of them. So I'll manage expectations right up front here and predict that we're going to get through maybe half if we're lucky. And for those that we don't get to in this segment, we will release in another segment within the next couple of weeks. So why don't we get started with one of the most popular questions, which has to do with the market correction call that you made a couple of months ago, Chris.
The call specifically was that there was an asymmetrical chance of the stock market maybe having a big rout, being down as much as 40 or maybe more percent compared to the chance of it going up a lot higher. And I made that call back in February, and what I was looking at there was really a number of things. First, that the stock market was very extended. Secondarily, that it was obviously very much dependent on whatever the Fed was about to do next, but that also there were certain fundamentals at play, which included things like seeing the expiry of the payroll tax credit, watching additional tax hikes come across the board for most people, seeing that Obamacare was going to be coming forward later on and starting to put some pressure on as people started to digest what that was going to mean. So just generally speaking, I thought there were fundamental reasons, but the biggest one was looking at some data by John Hussman that really showed that where corporate profits are right now is just they're as high as they've ever been, and in fact, ever. And so the chance of a reversion to the mean is high in that sort of a situation. And secondarily, when a market is really extended and extended through fakery, it's not really supported by much. And so an example of that, I think, that's starting to play out is what we're seeing happening in Japan. That market is up, it almost was up 100% from November through to about as of maybe a week ago. And now it's starting to fall and fall hard. And that's just the nature of markets that are inflated on the basis of hopes, expectations, fakery, and thin air money and all the rest. So I still think that there's a very high chance of a very serious market correction, and that was really contained in a piece I wrote recently where I noted that we're in a bubble territory again. Everything's priced to perfection. Everything from junk bonds, muni bonds, sovereign bonds, stock markets all across the world, everything seems to sort of be in a bubble with the odd man out of gold, of course, at this particular moment in time. And so some of this is hard to quantify too. But this market is about as nutty as anything I've ever seen. And I've seen some nutty ones. Was there for the tech bubble in the late 90s. Wasn't paying as much attention as I certainly was watching what happened as we ran up through 2007. I was playing that market very actively. This market feels like the 2007 market, only it's bigger, it's badder, and I think the potential downside is meaner. So I'm still very cautious between here and fall. And the way I position for that personally is to not be playing that particular game myself. I'm not even positioned short at this point in time. I told everybody I would let you know if I ever decided to re-enter the stock market one way or the other, but I'm pretty well cleanly out of that thing, have been for a long time. And I'm sitting on an increasing pile of cash as I watch carefully to see where next I want to make my move. So what I'm mostly doing is mentally positioning myself for the idea that there will be buying opportunities in the future, and one might come as early as this fall. And that would be a moment to analyze and take a look. But let's make no mistake, if this market comes crashing down, it's going to be very scary. It's going to be a pretty frightening moment. It's going to upend a lot of cherished beliefs that people are holding at this point in time. It's going to reshatter whatever faith has been built in the system, the Fed, institutions, all of that. And so I do think it'll be a moment where we have to be ready to reach out and help people who are potentially experiencing that as another frightening moment and might become paralyzed in terms of what they should do or how they should react.
Okay. Definitely a sobering prediction. You and I talked briefly about this yesterday, about the fact that you weren't taking a short position at this point in time.
Right.
And if I could reword what you said to me yesterday, you can tell me if I'm correct or if I'm on the mark here, which was things are so stretched, you do expect fairly violent moves coming up, as you just described. because the markets are so driven by intervention right now, by central planners, one of the reasons why I took away that you weren't short is because I think your expectation is that, you know, as things begin to truly run off the rails, they are going to up their efforts, and they're going to do all they can to try to whipsaw this thing back onto the rails. And therefore, even though we may be able to predict with a fair amount of confidence sort of where this is going to end up, you know, even perhaps as soon as this fall, the route which we take to get there is still highly unknown and will probably have, you know, lots of twists and turns. And therefore, you know, taking a straight strategy like simply just, you know, going short the market, you might get whipsawed enough there that you may actually end up losing some money. So from your perspective, much better and safer just to get out of the game, build dry powder. As I understand it, you know, as you mentioned, you've got a growing position in cash, but I also understand that you're not selling any of the precious metals that you've accumulated, and you're basically, you know, staying in dry powder and also maybe making some investments in your personal preparations, and then you're going to wait to see sort of what happens when the dust settles, and at that time, you know, there may be great opportunities to deploy some of that dry powder. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. Let me add one thing to that, which is that I am doubling down on my homestead efforts, such things as I feel I can do and can invest in at this point in time to continue to build my resiliency. Makes a lot of sense, because I really think that if the market does give way, and let's be clear, it will only do so despite the best efforts of our central interveners who are very actively manipulating these markets on a daily basis. If you want to see them do it relatively overtly, just look at Japan. Look at the stick saves that happen. Watch the Bank of Japan come out and make new announcements about how they're going to double down on their bond purchases, and they're very openly intervening in all of their markets over there right now. I would submit to you that other sorts of interventions are happening in other markets in the world, maybe less overtly, but to somebody with an eye for how the tape operates and can watch prices move, there's very clearly moments when things are not, let's say, explainable through fundamental analysis. In fact, I truly believe there's very little analysis that will help you here except this, which is how do we know that people behave in times of crisis when they're backed into a corner. The world central banks are backed into a corner. They're willing, ready, and able to try anything to prevent having to admit failure, to having to live with the consequences of what might happen if the third bubble in the series breaks, and it will. But they don't want to admit that. So the best I can think to do at this point in time is sit back, keep good context, understand what's going on, watch what's happening very carefully, and just keep going with my personal resiliency efforts, because I think that if they lose it on this one, and they might, there's a good chance, but if they do, it's going to be an awkward period to try and get anything big and substantial done at that point in time, you know, installing solar systems or ordering things or just figuring out what's going on. Because I think we'll be in a bit of a triage moment if that happens.
Yeah, probably not too dissimilar to what we got a little sneak peek of a few weeks ago when precious metal prices got beaten down so low, which was the people that had waited for spot prices, you know, for silver in the low 20s or gold in the 1300s, finally got those spot prices. The problem was they couldn't actually find any physical bullion to be bought for those prices.
Right.
You know, either the premiums were much higher than they would have liked, or the inventory availability just was not there. So, you know, to your point, if you're waiting to making some of these personal preparation purchases, at least for the important ones, better to do it now while supplies are still well available. All right, great. Well, I'd like to move into an interesting set of questions that we receive now, less about the economy and more about resiliency. We don't really get to talk about these as much on these podcasts, so I want to put these up front and center here. And I'm really excited we have Becca with us because, you know, Becca, you are essential to the seminars that we run every year, which really dive deeply in these topics. So please chime in liberally here through the process. This is kind of a fun question from reader Brack. What interesting projects or innovations have the Martinsons and Taggarts been deploying in their homesteads lately?
All right. Well, Becca certainly can answer that because we've been busy this spring.
Oh, it's been so much fun. There's been a lot of layered work happening here. One of the things that we've been working on in our orchard, which was planted three years ago now, is working on getting some permaculture plantings in at the base of the trees so that the trees themselves are not planted just alone with grass around them. So now at the base of the trees, I'm putting in comfrey and yarrow and red clover and various other things that each have different design elements. Some are deep nutrient pumps that pull up nutrients from deep in the soil. Others are early pollinator attractors. And it's just beautiful. It's beautiful to see those, in permaculture, they call it a guild, to see this grouping of plants really coming together under the trees. So that's one project that I've been working on that's been a lot of fun.
Interesting.
Yep, I have bees coming tomorrow. I'm getting both packages that I ordered, which is a big surprise. So been getting the area prepped for the hives. And I have to go extra special because I have to put a full electric fence around. And that's courtesy of the black bear who comes and snacks on our bird feeders every single night and will certainly snack on the hives if I'm not careful. So I've got to do that. And then I also put in, interestingly, yesterday I put in a toad habitat, which is some stacked rocks that creating a place a toad might like to hide, because I've been getting killed with the cutworms in my vegetable garden this year. And for those who don't know, a cutworm is a caterpillar from a moth that lives mostly underground but comes out at night, and it's really particularly wasteful. What it does to feed is it actually cuts your young plants off at the stem and just drops them like it's a logger felling a tree. And then they eat a little bit of it, and then they go and they do that to the next plant. So those have, I've just been getting killed with those. So I'm hoping the toads who come out at night and tend to feed on cutworms will be a help to that, because otherwise it's just been it's been wreckage in the old Martinson veggie patch. So that's a couple of things we've had going on. How about you, Adam?
Well, as you guys know, and I think most of the readers know, I moved to a much more sustainable part of the country a little bit less than a year ago. And so I'm, for the first time, deploying a lot of these elements that you guys have already deployed on your properties. I think the one area where I might be ahead of you is in the bees. I like to rub that in when I can. But when you guys were out here a couple of months ago, you saw a couple of the gardening innovations that they're relatively simple, but I really like how well they're performing. The first is the potato tower, and I know we were just talking about this as we were getting this call set up, but this essentially is, if you want to raise potatoes but you don't want to grow them in rows and take up a lot of your garden space, you grow them in a tower that you build as the plants themselves grow, and you can do all of this in a 2x2 square within your garden. Essentially what you do is you just take boards and you make an initial frame, a 2-foot by 2-foot frame, and you put some dirt in there and put some seed potatoes, and as the plants begin to grow, as they get about a foot in height, you put another layer of boards around them and fill that in with soil, and you just repeat up until the plant gets to about head height, which is where mine are right now. So the potatoes have just been loving it, and presumably I'm supposed to get 100 pounds of potatoes out of this tower, and it's only taking up a 2-foot by 2-foot square in my garden.
Well, I have one of those going as well, so we'll compare notes and see how those turn out. And I guess also one of the things I've been doing is just generally bringing in nutrients, and I've been adding fertilizer and compost and all kinds of things to just the whole general yard, because I realized that, you know, in our sandy soil here, it would just be a good idea to have the whole place as nutrient dense as possible, while nutrients are easy to come by and big trucks will show up with tasty compost and all kinds of things. So I've just generally been adding to the nutrient abundance to the overall property.
Well, you and I talk about this a lot. I mean, that's sort of like your homestead savings account. And in many ways, fertile soil is about the best investment you can be making. So good for you for doing that.
One of the other things that we've done this spring is we've put in a number of elderberry plants, which I'm really excited about. This is a perennial shrub that will get quite big that I use to make medicine for the family for winter viruses and flus. It's a phenomenal healing berry. It can be used to make wine and all sorts of things. So I'm really excited about the elderberries. And one of the other things that's happening in our orchard/chicken coop zone is that in the areas where the chickens have turned the grass to dirt, we've planted buckwheat. And the buckwheat is awesome because as it grows big, it will be fodder for the chickens, as well as when it flowers, it'll be phenomenal for the bees that are coming. So there's a lot of stacked functions happening in our orchard that I really enjoy.
Now, you know what's interesting, though, is this sounds like a lot of work, and it is, and we haven't done it all ourselves, and it's very interesting how when I look out in my yard, I never quite know who's going to be out there working, and that's because of you, Becca. So what's going on out in our yard?
Well, I love doing work trade. I do a lot of personal therapeutic counseling work with people, and a lot of folks in my neck of the woods do not have a lot of cash on hand, and so I do work trade. And we have lots of young people in particular in the area, permaculture specialists that come in and will trade a few hours of labor for some counseling time. So I love that. I love how it builds the web of connections in the community and the richness of relationships, and I love how it is basically keeping our resources out of the system in a lot of ways. My neighbor, Janie, is an absolute genius at this, and she has bartered and traded and work traded for so many things in her neck of the woods, and it's just been a real inspiration to watch, so I'm trying to follow suit.
Oh, it's great to hear. On the community side over here, and again, I live on the other side of the country as you guys. I've recently gotten involved in the local Grange. And for those that don't know what a Grange is really this communal resource where historically farmers gather together and basically share resources, insights about the trade, and basically just to try to help support the local farming community. Where I live, there's this real tension going on in the local area where used to be a very big farming community here. Apples used to be the big crop. They've been getting replaced over the past decade or two by vineyards. So you're losing a lot of food production to wine grape production. And there's an orchard that's being torn up around the school, actually the school where my children go to. And the community has gotten together at the Grange to understand how the vineyard that's going in, where the apple orchard's being torn up, is going to be spraying and applying pesticides. And there's been a really interesting sort of civic democracy process going on there where you've seen, you know, local residents getting out there and basically expressing their interests and their priorities for community health, and yet trying to do so and work with these producers in a way, these commercial producers in a way where, you know, they can still run their businesses and still bring income into the community. And so I think having that sort of community involvement, it's really sort of essential to a thriving, supportive, sustainable community, because it's very clear to see that this could easily be handled a different way where you'd have both parties be much more antagonistic of each other. And it sounds like in decades past, that's more the way these things went. But as you see people actually trying to, you know, bridge the gaps and have the commercial interests understand the needs of the community, and the community understands that the commercial interests, you know, play an important role as well. Just like your WorkShare program, it's an opportunity to bring the community actually closer together in resilience than divided, where I think that so often can happen.
Excellent, excellent. Well, what's the next question?
All right, the next question is from Ken Kelly, 89. For those without a permanent homestead, people that rent or move frequently for work, how should they prioritize building resilience? What advice do you have for them?
You know, this is something, whether you have money or resources or not, or whether you live in an urban area or just a fully rural area, actually the most important resilience you can build is emotional resilience. I know we've had a number of posts on that lately, and I'm really glad Becca's here with us today, because honestly, you know, this is something that we work on quite a bit in the seminars that we give. We've got one coming up at Kripalu. It's the last one in 2013. I think it's going to be really well timed, given what I think is coming up this fall. But honestly, the first thing you have to work on is building your emotional resilience, and then what you were just talking about, Adam, that community resilience. The community, you know, like if I lived in Brooklyn, I'd be thrilled because they've got the whole hipster thing going on, and they've got organic food, and they're doing bees. And I mean, these sorts of resilience efforts, whether they're around food, community, emotional resilience, all those things are happening everywhere, even in the most urban of areas. And even if you don't have a permanent homestead, your community can still, in the sense that you're renting, your community is still a permanent aspect of who you are and all of that, and it cannot be taken away based on your ownership. So this is something where, you know, when we work with whole groups of people at the seminars, one of the things that's really obvious is the sense that most people bring into this. I think this is the most common thing, is people, when we query them on the first day and say, all right, you know, really tell us about yourselves and what you're bringing and what you're hoping to get out of this here over the weekend. The first thing that comes up is this sense of people feeling like they lead dual lives, that they've got a foot in two worlds, that they've got the regular world where they work and earn money and talk to people about sports and things. And they've got this other world, which is sort of the peak prosperity world where we're aware of, and we converse in a range of subjects that have some pretty big implications. And so managing, how do you manage being in both those worlds? You know, that is not an easy topic, and that's something that you have to manage regardless of whether you rent, whether you own, whether you're rural, whether you're urban, old or young, it doesn't matter. So this is a sense of, you know, something that I think everybody can work on and should be working on is how do they really start to marry the worlds that they live in? How do they be sure that the people that they love the most or spend the most time with, whether those are friends, colleagues, spouses, whatever, that you're aligned as well as you can be so that you're sharing this common vision of what the future is going to hold and your role and what that's going to be in it. And then really deciding what are those next things you're going to work on. These are all big, big, meaty, awesome questions, but they're things that obviously can be worked on. And I don't have time to go into all of them here in this podcast, but I will tell you that these are all things that we chew on pretty deeply at the seminars.
And one of the things that I want to bring up, Chris, is you remember that group that came to Roe, our seminar at Roe 2 years ago, that actually came with a large group of people from our neighborhood, from our neck of the woods, from our town.
Yep.
And I would say a large group of people, actually it was probably maybe 6 people from our region. And when they came back from the seminar, they got together and formed a resilience group, which then grew from those 6 people to, I think it's up to about 18 people now. And they've been meeting every other week for 2 years. And the connections that they formed around preparation were phenomenal. And it went way beyond just preparing. They absolutely are supporting one another emotionally in very deep and significant ways. And they're doing fun things. This weekend, they're going on a canoe trip together. So they're building all of these connections through work parties. They stack wood together. They garden together. They can food together. And it's a really beautiful thing to see the way people can enrich their lives through the pursuit of resilient-based activities. And again, because these people together came to the seminar, they had that baseline understanding that they then, that was like a nucleus around which other people could join the group after that. And it was really, really beautiful.
Well, that's great, Becca. And let's take an opportunity here just to drill a little bit more specifically into what actually happens at these seminars. I think people see us promote them on the site, but they may not really have a clear picture as to what exactly goes on during the seminars. Do you have a moment to just talk about some of the specific exercises and focuses that go on during this weekend and the benefits of each?
Absolutely. Well, before I talk about any of the specific, you know, modules that we cover there, I think one of the most important things that happens for people when they come to the seminars is they meet with other like-minded people who don't think they're crazy. And this just is priceless. I mean, it's one of the first things that people say they're so excited about, to be able to be in a room with 60 other people and nobody thinks they're nuts and they don't have to explain themselves. That's has a tremendous value. And again, one of the other things that happens that's really beautiful is the connections that people make offline during meals and during downtime. There's a really wonderful cohesion that happens. Another thing, Adam, is that when one of the things that we dive into pretty extensively is how to work with a reluctant partner, spouse, neighbor, friend, family member. And this is really potent information for just about everybody in the room. And we've had many, many experiences of people that have been following the Crash Course and peak prosperity issues for a long time, bringing their partner who is maybe not all that excited about these ideas or doesn't really want to engage. And when they leave, both of them feel more connected to the other's position. There's just something that happens that is really quite magical. So I really encourage people that do have reluctant partners to bring them along. Kerpalu is such a great venue as well. There's, you know, all sorts of body treatments and yoga, and it's in a beautiful, beautiful environment with really, really awesome food. And so it's a lovely place to bring someone.
Yeah, it's a nice place to hang out.
Yeah. But in terms of, you know, the specific material that we cover, we spend a lot of time talking about the emotional side of resilience. We talk about working with reluctant partner. We talk about the specific physical preparations that we've made and share best practices with each other around other preparations that other people have made. We dive into, we usually have some folks that come in and make some specific presentations on financial resilience. And then we also talk about what types of things might get in the way of those steps that you know you need to take in order to move towards resilience. So what are those barriers to action that might come up? It's a really wonderful flow. We really enjoy working with people there. There's just a magic that happens that's kind of hard to put into words.
You know, we get lots of really very powerful feedback from people who manage the sites that we give these seminars at, saying that it's among the best seminars they've ever seen. It's got a very nice flow. It's a great product all on its own. But the thing that I like most about it is, and one piece of feedback that I would love to share is that we've heard a number of times from people who said this really could be billed as a couples workshop,
because
a lot of healing has gone on. And again, this isn't about making one couple, part of the couple, see the other's position. It's really about opening up the dialogue, being in a very safe, contained place, and allowing the conversation to flow. And it's really about those moments of having the opportunity. The one thing that we work very hard to bring people towards is that idea of releasing your own need and desire to change how somebody else is thinking about something. That's one little nugget from this that I'll reveal here. It's around just coming to acceptance of both where you are with this material and where other people are. If the crash course is this big left brain tour, the weekend is on the right side of the brain. We have to synthesize those two parts. The heart and the head have to come together. And so it's a transformative weekend. It's very well crafted. It gives people an opportunity to engage with each other. And the thing I'm most proud of is in the example Becca gave of this group that came back and has been operating for several years now after the fact, I've heard about some of the largest individual and community-oriented transformations that happened as a consequence that happened after people came to the weekend. So it's really about moving to action. It's about identifying those things that might prevent us from moving to action. And it's about doing it in a way that's uplifting, it's fun, it's encouraging. Given what we're talking about, how do you do that? Well, it's possible.
Yep, and your point about action, a very important objective of the weekend is for people throughout the course of the seminar to identify the steps that they need to take most next in their life in terms of building resiliency. So, if you're somebody that hasn't really started along this journey yet, it's a great way to get oriented. And if you're somebody who's been doing it but perhaps has gotten busy with the other demands of life or feel like you've sort of plateaued and need a little bit of maybe a gentle shove or some additional direction as to where to head next, it gives you that boost and renewed sense of direction and purpose and I think optimism of what you're saying coming out of it.
Absolutely. And, one of the other things, Adam, just to loop back to the original question, which was around what do people do if they don't have land to prepare for and resilience? Chris and I both were renting for a number of years, and we did all sorts of things on the land that we were renting. And Adam, I know that you did as well. And just some simple advice and feedback on our own personal experiences of doing this type of work for many, many years is extremely helpful for people.
Yeah, and in fact, I actually am still renting, so I'm still deploying a lot of these actions on land I know I'm not going to own for the long haul. And the one thing I'd underscore about that is, even before I moved up where I live now, I lived prior in the heart of Silicon Valley suburbia, definitely not a resilient community. But I still managed to have chickens and bees and a square foot garden, and I did it all on a really small scale. And I wasn't fooling myself. None of it was to support myself in any way in terms of calories or whatnot. I consider it my tuition. Really, it's how can I make sure I get some exposure to these skills so that when I finally have the opportunity, whether it's land I own or land I know I'm going to be at for a long time, I'm actually building that knowledge base versus having to start from scratch. So I really recommend that's how people look at it. And to your point, Becca, looking at models, whether it's what you guys are doing or I'm doing or the other participants at the seminar are doing. It's a great way to learn and get inspired and to, you know, the point you've been underscoring. These are relationships that you then take away from the weekend where, you know, these are people who are going to support you both emotionally and by sharing, you know, their knowledge with you going forward. And one of the great things about that is it really saves you, in many cases, years of learning from the school of hard knocks as to how not to do things. Because as most people who know that have gone out and started implementing some of these resilient steps, you know, you very quickly realize that there's a lot of ways to do it wrong, and it takes you a while to really learn how to do it right. And if people can help save you time there, it's invaluable.
That's important. And the most important thing, of course, as we look at how the markets are just crazy and the whole world is trying to convince us that, you know, everything's back on track and whatnot, it's so essential to have time and a generous amount of time to sit down with people who share your outlook and openly converse around these things. And I will just, again, reiterate that this snapshot of people who come to this are all across the board, but generally speaking, fairly successful in one way or another. You know, we have a lot of professionals, doctors, lawyers, whatnot, a lot of people who've made their mark in life in one way or another and now happen to hold the idea that big change is coming and want an open place to talk about it. That alone is just critical. So that sense of isolation just falls away. That's my favorite time, to have time, generous amount of time to really get to know people and to watch people have the opportunity to get to know each other. That's the best part about all of this, and it's why we do it. It certainly takes it's a bit of a time commitment on our end, and it's worth it. It really is.
All right. Well, since we've now done a deep dive on the seminar, we may as well tell folks when it is. It's this coming July, July 19th through Sunday. That's a Friday, and through Sunday, July 21st. And that's going to be at Kripalu, which is in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, which is in Western Mass, up in the Berkshires, and it's a beautiful time to be there. Heart of summer, there's a great big lake. It's really a special time to be in a place that special. I'm just looking at the time here. As always, we've had great questions and great material to dig into. I don't want to shortchange the remaining questions we were asked, so maybe I'll ask one more that's on the continued resilience theme here. And then we'll cut this segment short, and then we'll tackle the rest of the questions in another segment in a week or so.
I have a vote. How about the one from Rain?
How about the one from Rain? Okay, let's do that. I think it's a great one with both you and Becky here on the phone. All right, from user Rain, he asks, how much of the crash course is appropriate for kids? Are there elements of your thinking you don't share with your children?
So I'll take the first part of that. How much is appropriate for kids? Well, all of it. We've had sixth graders take the money part and teach it to their class, and we certainly haven't held back any of the thinking around our views from our kids, and we believe they're happier, healthier, and more well-adjusted for it. But I'm going to let Becca really dive on this one.
Well, I think it really depends on how old your children are. Obviously, you're not going to be talking to a three-year-old child about issues of peak oil. And I think that it's less what you talk about with your children and more the energy that you carry around it. So if you are really fearful and anxious about everything unfolding, that's the energy that your kids are going to pick up on. So Chris and I tend to, because we work through so many of the emotional stages of awareness on this material, you know, and we're both at a stage of acceptance, that's the energy that we impart to our children when we talk about it. One of the things that we really recommend is to just start taking your resilience actions, get your kids involved in the gardening and the bees and whatever else you're doing. And younger children don't need to understand the whys of what you're doing. There's enough joy and connectedness in the actions themselves. They don't really need to understand why. Young children really, I wouldn't talk directly to young children about issues of, you know, resource scarcity and peak oil and things like that. Now, once you get into the teenage range, preteen and teenage range, your children are much more ready to be able to handle larger issues. But again, the key is what is your state of emotional response when you talk to them? That is the most important thing.
Well, here's something that I've learned as well. Once you're in the preteen to teenage years, there's this idea that some people hold, which is that, well, I don't know if I should reveal this thinking. I don't know if I should share with them these larger concerns. Hey, in my experience, they already know. Kids have already figured out that something is wrong with this story, just economically. When I talk, there's a generational gap in this country right now, and it's pretty profound, and I'm sure you would find one even just more profound in say, Spain or Greece, where most of the people under the age of 30 are now unemployed. They've already figured out something's wrong with their narrative over there, too. And here's how the story breaks down right now. For a lot of people who are in the boomer generation, who are at or nearing retirement, or you know, can see it coming soon, they have everything to gain by preserving the status quo. They don't want their pensions to go away and their entitlement programs to go away. They've worked hard and they've put into the system, and so they're ready to grab that brass ring. So they're in many respects characterized by wanting to preserve the status quo. And on the other side of the generational spectrum, you have the young people looking at that same narrative saying, I have nothing to gain by preserving the status quo. If preserving the status quo means I get to pick up and service all of the debts that have been left behind, the crumbling infrastructure, the lack of fidelity between corporations and their workers, there's a lot in the story there where young people don't want to participate in that story and often don't. And so we have to close that gap because, you know, sooner or later that gap resolves itself. And so we should manage that as much as possible. And it begins by making sure that you're having honest conversations with your children. And I will echo two of Becca's sentiments here, which is once they're in the preteen to teen range, totally fine. They can handle it. And be sure that you are approaching it in a non-alarmist state, meaning don't hide your feelings, but work through your emotional progression on this so you're not approaching these topics from a place of anxiety, of fear, of depression, of whatever emotional state might get triggered because of this material. Open, honest conversations. Kids are ready for it. They can handle it. And guess what? They've already been exposed to these ideas, and they're already thinking them whether you're aware of it or not. That's been my learning so far.
And I would really use the crash course videos themselves as the teaching tool because they're short, they're clear, they're easy to understand, they do not have an emotional charge attached to them, and they're just a great way to introduce young people to these ideas.
Well, I think that's all great advice. And with that, I'm going to draw an end to going down the list here. We probably hit about a third, to be honest, of the questions that were asked. But to those listening, I promise we'll get to them in a future installment. Chris and Becca, thank you very much. Becca, thank you so much for coming to join us. It's a total treat.
It's a pleasure to be here, Adam.
All right. Thanks, Adam, and thanks, Becca. And we'll do this again soon, Adam, and you and I will cover the rest of these questions in a couple of weeks, probably.
All righty. We'll do so then.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.